To Radio Free Nintendo, episode 276. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
Much love to Sarah from Iowa. I got you, girl.
James Jones.
Shockingly, he's married.
And Greg Leahy.
Hello.
Oh, man. If you are not following this gang on Twitter, you are missing out on some ridiculous stuff, which is not of our own device, let me tell you. But the way people are interacting with us on Twitter has been taken to the strangest place this week, and it leads me to once again reiterate my claim that I will stand by, which is that Twitter is the best iPhone game. It's certainly been by far the most entertaining thing that I do on my phone. So, all right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a Nintendo podcast for you. And we're going to do new business and listener mail in the second half of the show. So I'll kick it off this week with a Wii game. It's not a new Wii game, but it is a game that not many people have played, unfortunately. We've brought it up on the show a couple of times before. But it bears repeating, and that game is Trauma Team by Atlus. You know, I'm a big fan of the Trauma series. I've played all of them. I like almost all of them. I'm not a big fan of Trauma Center Under the Knife 2 for DS. I think it's kind of lazy. But I like all the rest of them. And Trauma Team just, as I said the last time, I mean, I picked this game up after not playing it for over a year, I think. You know, in the course of my New Year's resolution of not buying new games, I am sort of going through a combination of playing games that I bought recently and also playing games that I bought a long time ago and never got around to playing or never got around to finishing. And Trauma Team is a game that I couldn't even tell you why I stopped playing it, because I was loving it and then something else came along and I just never got around to going back to it. So I was excited and very happy to start playing it again, and it has held up very, very well, and I'm now very close to the end. I'm getting close to about 23, 24 hours into it. I think it's going to be over 25 by the time I'm finished. It is a
surprisingly long game.
Yeah. I mean, compared to the other Trauma Center games, which are all under 10 hours easily, it is a shockingly big, expansive game. And I feel like it's not just long, but the scope of it is so much greater, because you do have six characters and six different kinds of gameplay. They're not all different kinds of operations, but just in gameplay, period. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but the medical examiner, the forensic pathologist, whatever you want to call her, Naomi Kimishima, her gameplay is so good. So good. And the stories are really interesting, too. I mean, these people are killed in the strangest ways, but those chapters are by far the longest in the game. So they're all over an hour long, I think, and there's at least six or seven or eight of them.
And some of them are really off-putting, like, in a good way. You're like, oh.
Oh, yeah, here's where nails broke off glowing at the door.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah.
That is the exact discovery I was thinking of that really made me go, oh, my God.
There's some pretty gruesome stuff, and it's funny because the most gruesome stuff is in the story and not necessarily in the artwork. The part where you actually examine a body, even though it says performing autopsy when you start the chapter, that's not really what that gameplay is about. It's more about deductive reasoning. And to me, it's basically what I always wanted Phoenix Wright to be, because you're sort of indirectly asking people questions, you're collecting evidence at the crime scene, you're looking at the body and the clothes that they were wearing, and you're looking for clues on there, and you're running tests, and you're getting analysis done. And all that stuff is neat, but the really amazing thing is the way that it organizes all this information. You know, this is kind of like looking into the mind of Sherlock Holmes or something, because all the different pieces of the case are arranged on basically cards. And so right. You can sort of visually see all the current mysteries, all the current pieces of evidence you have, and slowly as you work your way through the case, as you collect more of these and understand them better, the cards get upgraded, they add more stars to it, meaning that you've kind of developed that piece of information a little bit further. And then you start to combine them together, and eventually they become pieces of solid evidence, which is when the card turns gold. And you basically want to get all of the cards to turn gold by merging them together and advancing your understanding of them. And then at the very end of the mission, Naomi sort of walks through the entire case from start to finish. You know, she kind of sets up a phrase and she says, and the reason that he killed his brother is, and then you have to pick the gold card that you develop throughout the case and use that to explain what it is. And I have picked the wrong one before. And that's the really surprising thing, because you've been playing this case for over an hour and you feel like you understand all the little details and you've really thought a lot about how to put all this stuff together. But those missions are so clever in setting up questions for you to answer that really force you to pay attention and in some cases make a little bit of a leap of logic beyond the information that they presented. You actually have to put things together in order to answer this question correctly. And it really kind of respects the player's intelligence a lot, and it asks you to really think about what you're answering here, because you can very easily get these questions wrong. It's very, very, very impressive stuff, and I think it's amazing. And to me, you could easily make an entire game of just this stuff. In fact, you could take these cases from out of Trauma Team, and it's already almost its own game. To me, it's almost like all the other stuff, all the surgeries and the diagnostics and everything, all those are almost icing on the cake because the medical examiner stuff is so good.
What I actually like about it is that you start the game and you're getting six discrete stories effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And what you realize, you can realize pretty quickly, is that these stories all are really interconnected. And then at the end, they really do bring them all together. And you realize the whole time you were all working the same thing.
Hmm.
It's a neat feeling, because as you're working through them, you start to see pieces connect, but you can't see the forest for the trees, because it's not until late in the game where you really rise above everything and get the whole broad perspective of what you're seeing.
I'm not even there yet. I mean, I kind of see that it seems like it's going that way, but there's still a lot of stuff that I don't really see how it's going to fit in.
Well, there's a little bit of hand-waving at some point. You know, this is a bit fantastical for this game.
Yeah.
But it's not guilt. I mean, it's not that bad.
Yeah, I think that is one thing I really like about it. One of my complaints with the early Trauma Center games is that they're a little too sci-fi. You know, I mean, I think it's neat, and a lot of the artwork for the guilt, or whatever the follow-up to that was, a lot of it's really cool, because it's like these kind of alien-looking viruses, and they're moving around people's organs, and you're chasing them with your medical laser. It's a neat idea. But at some point, you really kind of lose the attachment to the characters and the sense that you're doing something that could be real, you know? You kind of lose that sense of immersion, like, wow, I'm really performing surgery here. No, you're not. You're killing an alien with a laser gun. So Trauma Team feels much, much, much more grounded in actual medical procedures, and the story is just so much more realistic and believable. And the characters, therefore, are more believable, and you actually care what happens to them more, except for the girl with the squealy voice who does first aid. Because she can die in a fire.
You're supposed to hate her.
She's insufferable.
I'm sure you are, but boy, do I hate her.
She does do a little bit of self-redemption, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Otherwise, I like all the characters, and I even like a lot of the supporting characters, which have usually been pretty irritating in the Trauma Center series. So,
oh, the nurses?
Yeah, the nurses are just way too perky. I mean, they're basically Vanna White, you know, with a tray of metal tools. And so they've gotten a lot better with that stuff. And I really feel like this series has matured so much in a pretty brief span of time. And I'm so impressed by this. And I really feel like Trauma Team, I mean, I already liked it a lot the first time I played it. Now that I've played a lot more of it, more than double what I had before, I'm really feeling like this is one of my favorite Wii games. And I really feel like it uses the Wii hardware in a way that you would really probably not ever play this game on any other system, including DS, where the series started.
Right.
I guess you could do it with Move.
But you'd have to own a Move.
But I really feel like this is a game that is incredibly well-tailored to the Wii platform, and yet it doesn't feel gimmicky. And even the part with the endoscope, which I felt was really gimmicky when I first started the game, after a while, I feel like the frustration of using that thing is actually part of the experience. I think it's very intentional. The idea that it's very easy to accidentally move it too far and run into a wall, and it's sort of laborious to aim it and redirect the direction that you're pointing. All of that, it starts to feel after a while like that's the way that it should feel because you're running a friggin' tube through somebody's arteries.
Yeah, it gets really stressful later, which I think sort of alleviates the frustration because now it becomes just pure, oh God, don't make mistake, don't make mistake.
Yeah.
Versus this is really obnoxious. Why do I have to keep going further in? It becomes more of a finesse thing than a straight repetition.
Yeah. It's such an impressive game, and I feel bad that I've had it just sitting there for so long without actually finishing it. And unfortunately, it's an Atlas game, so, you know, if my description strikes your fancy, you're probably going to have a hard time coming by a copy of it if you don't already have one. But I feel like this is a game that would deserve some kind of re-release at some point. I hope that it'll become available once again for some people because it's so good.
You know, it looks like it's shockingly affordable for an Atlas game online.
Hmm. Go forth, RFN Nation. Pick up Trauma Team. It is, it's a pretty amazing Wii game. It really is. I think it's wonderful. So the only other thing I wanted to bring up this week is I did play a few hours of KOTOR. That would be Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. The old, old one. Not the friggin' MMO. But the old RPG that was for Xbox One. And I'm playing it on PC, and it's been a fun experience to kind of see what the fuss is about. You know, this is a very revered game, and I'm still early enough that I haven't seen any lightsabers, really. I haven't been on a starship except for the little tutorial area you start in. But I'm running down quests, and I'm meeting a lot of interesting characters, and of course there's a lot of political factions going on behind the scenes, and you get embroiled in all kinds of conflicts.
So basically, it is Mass Effect with Star Wars versus...
I think so, because Mass Effect was the first BioWare game that I played. And this does remind me of Mass Effect in a lot of ways, especially when you're talking to characters. Not so much when you're running around playing the game. You know, the action parts aren't really action. They're just kind of click on things.
Right.
And watch bad animation play out until the enemy
well,
dies.
It is an old game.
It is old. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to be forgiving on that stuff. But the writing is pretty good. The voice acting, very uneven. And that's a place where they'd come a long way by the time they did Mass Effect. They had really upped the production value on stuff like voice acting. You know, back when KOTOR came out, it was probably very novel that an RPG was fully voice acted. Period.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty cool game. The RPG stuff is interesting because if you go into the menus and look at your, you know, look at what some of the items do, like if you have some kind of stim pack that's supposed to accelerate your reflexes or something, it's talking about like adding modifiers to D20s and stuff. And I'm like, damn, this is Dungeons and Dragons with Star Wars on top of it. Like it's all this old D&D stuff underneath the hood. It's really weird.
Yeah, I think to an extent, the use of things like D20s isn't probably limited to games. Mass appeal, as it were.
Well, the thing is, you could easily play this game and never know that it's doing dice rolls. But because all that stuff is hidden, but it's like when you go in and read the descriptions of how these items really work and what they actually do, they don't give you an effect, they give you a chance to get an effect. And that's where all that stuff comes into play, and it's really strange, but that's in the real nitty-gritty details, and you could easily just overlook all that stuff.
Yeah, I feel like this game, it's not revered like something like Baldur's Gate is, you know? Everybody's like, oh, you know, that was such a great game. It's a classic. But KOTOR, you rarely hear it talked about in those kinds of...
Well, could it be that Baldur's Gate is... I mean, it's fan service for a very dedicated group that doesn't get quite as much fan service as, say, Star Wars fans.
It's true.
Yeah. I mean, Baldur's Gate is porn for lazy dungeon masters. It really is. But there's plenty of Star Wars, well, there's plenty of Star Wars porn. But there's plenty of
What's your favorite, James?
I mean, actually, there were a lot of good Star Wars games that generation, and there was Bounty Hunter, which was not a good game, but there were a lot of good ones.
I still want Nintendo to announce a new Star Wars game for Wii U.
That'd be pretty cool.
How about Wii U Star Wars? It's like Kinect Star Wars, but you use the whole tablet for your lightsaber.
Well, see, that's the best thing is that because Kinect Star Wars is still coming out and it will be bad.
Supposedly.
It will be bad when it finally comes out. I mean,
oh, it's going to be dreadful.
It'll be better than the E3 demo last year, but it's still not going to be a good game. For Nintendo to announce their own Star Wars game right about the same time that comes out that actually looks awesome and is exactly what people want, that would be a really great coup for them.
God, I really wish I could have been in the room when Kohler demoed that Star Wars game, because you know he said whatever he was thinking.
Oh, yes.
And I heard what he was thinking. It was not pleasant.
All right, John, so what do you have this week?
Not a whole heck of a lot. I'm still kind of going through the backlog, you know.
Good for you, though.
I'm playing games that aren't Skyward Sword, but I still have some. They're games that I have time left on. Skyward Sword, well, it'll jump back in the mix at some point, but, you know.
So, John, what have you been playing this week?
Well, one of the games that I kind of played for a while and said, wow, this game is really good, and then immediately abandoned was God of War 3.
Yeah.
So I've been playing that, just trying to clear that out. I'm probably about 3/4 of the way through it. And I was like, you know, it's always been kind of on my list to kind of play through. And it's worth playing through strictly for just seeing what the heck they do, because they do just some crazy stuff with their boss battles.
For sure.
It's a beautiful game. The boss battle I just had was one against Kronos, which is a Titan where I think it's in I played it so long ago. It may actually have been God of War 3 that I actually played this boss battle in. I can't remember. But I remember at some point,
my God,
possibly in God of War 3 or possibly one of the other God of War games, you fight on the back of this Titan, which is pretty amazing in itself, because you're on this huge moving humanoid creature while you're fighting around him up to the top.
Oh, yeah, that's the opening of God of War 3. You're kind of okay on him, and then later in the game, you actually have to kill him, which seems like impossible. It seems so unbelievable. You know, you fight other bosses running around on this guy's arm, and then later in the game, you actually have to kill him, and he's as big as a planet, basically.
Yeah, and that's the most amazing thing about the game is that the game engine, I mean, it's really amazing to watch it in action, because it will, I mean, the camera will zoom out to show him talking to you, and he's completely detailed, you know, and you're just a little speck, like, standing on his arm, fighting enemies, and then the camera will zoom all the way into Kratos, and his model in itself is incredibly detailed, and it's just amazing what they do with that. Just, it's so seamless, and it really makes you wonder, like, not to get, like, all, like, tech nerdy, but really, it kind of gives you the idea of really how many polygons their engine is actually handling.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of tricks they're doing to fool you into thinking that it can actually show all this stuff at the same time. But the tricks are good. I mean, they really work.
Yeah.
When you watch it, you're like, how the hell? That's the cool thing about God of War, is, like, it plays exactly the same as the other games in the series, but it looks so much better because they really sort of, the theme of the game is scale, and they play with scale so much, and it's just something you don't see many other games even try to do.
Yep. But the one thing that, you know, coming back to it, I feel like there's a whole lot, like, you can pull off all kinds of moves and all kinds of combos, but, you know, and a lot of games tend to do this, especially with, you know, a franchise game that's like the third or fourth in a series, where in order that they think to improve the game, they toss more and more combos into the mix. Like, oh, well, in game number 2, you could do 15 combos. Now you can do 50, and you'll use 2 of them through the entire game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, I wind up spamming, like, 2 or 3 moves, and that's it. Just because I don't really care enough. I mean, you know, this isn't Mortal Kombat. I don't care enough to learn every single combo, because it really does me no good. As long as I can just kill things with something dependably, I'll just use that. So I feel like there's a lot of moves in there that they added in that, I mean, if you look at the move list, it's a mile long in terms of the button combos and different kind of things you can do. And I'm just like, wow, I haven't used that, and that. And, you know, I feel like they could have probably streamlined that a bit more, because there's just kind of bloat to me. There's nobody uses that stuff mostly.
Yeah.
Maybe you would if you were playing it on, like, hardcore or anything like that.
God mode or whatever it's called.
Yeah, you probably would, but.
Or if you were God.
I think it's really clever that the highest difficulty level in the game is called God mode, because, you know, in old, like, first-person shooters, that would just mean that you're invincible and you can't die, and in God of War, it means that you will die every 3 seconds.
Yeah, it's a tough game. I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm playing it just to get through it, but, you know, and there's in certain areas I'm just scraping by, but that's fine. So probably next on the list after I beat that will be Gears of War 2 also. Actually, that'll be next up. That's another game that I was like, wow, this is really good, and I just abandoned it. So
John's playing all his mature games right now.
Yeah.
Mature games for mature adults like himself.
Gears 2 is really good. I think Gears 3 is a lot better, but Gears 2 is still worth finishing for sure. So Greg, you're up next.
Yep, and first of all, not related to anything that I've been playing, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that this very night, the European PAL Virtual Console Drought for Wii has come to an end.
It Yay. Did.
After, I think, Don Koopman in his story when we heard that Prince of Persia for Super Nintendo would be coming out this week, earlier in the week, he pegged it at 32 weeks.
He did, yes.
I think, which is incredibly long time to go without any updates. It's an interesting choice, though, isn't it? Being from Ubisoft, from a Western developer, it's something, you know, we did the episode a very long time ago now about the virtual console, the feature on that. You know, one of the things that we talked about as being the central sort of disparity between the Japanese virtual console and the Western ones is because Japan has all these games that are sort of exclusive to Japan that would appeal to Japan consumers that can sort of stuff the library. And yet, from Western developers, games that would be mostly known in the West, popular in the West, have been few and far between. You did have stuff like some of the LucasArts games, you know, Super Star Wars trilogy and the Indiana Jones things and all that kind of stuff, but it, very, very little of it. And it's just kind of bizarre to me that it's taken us, you know, here we are in 2012, 5 years after the Wii came out, you've just got around to something as sort of obvious as Ubisoft, a huge publisher, putting Prince of Persia on the Super Nintendo Virtual Console.
And it seems to be quite deliberately Ubisoft's decision to do this, because they released the Game Boy Color game the same day.
Yeah, that's another Game Boy Color game following up on Blaster Master for the Game Boy Virtual Console. Again, that's kind of a novelty. Hasn't been a lot of, you know, Western-developed games on the portable Virtual Console either. But anyway, I'm glad it's over. I don't think I'll be rushing to get Prince of Persia necessarily, and I've sort of become a bit of a Virtual Console supremacist nowadays. Can't go back to the PAL bordered 50-hertzness anymore, but it's still good news. And I hope it hasn't been confirmed for the US or anything, has it? But
no, it hasn't.
Hopefully that's a sign that we're going to have to break the deadlock over there as well soon. But I have been playing something suitably old-fashioned to follow up on that, which is Bionic Commando Virtual Console game for the Game Boy on 3DS. So obviously the original Bionic Commando for NES has never come out for the Virtual Console, presumably because of its thinly veiled Nazi references.
I wouldn't call them veiled.
Yeah, exactly. Thin is a bit too much credit, really, isn't it? But of course, you did have Bionic Commando Rearmed for PSN and 360 Live Arcade, so that's where I got to experience Bionic Commando for the first time. I never played the NES game. Now, with the Game Boy game, it's basically a sort of alternate version of the NES game, in that, first of all, it removes all the World War II stuff, not surprisingly, and sort of replaces it with anime futuristic stuff. But it's the same game. You're still trying to sort of take down the Albatross or whatever, the secret project, you know, this evil empire's got going. And you've got the same map, and certainly the levels are not exactly the same, but they have a lot of the same concepts and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if you've played Bionic Commando in any form, this is familiar territory, admittedly. Now, of course, being that it's on the Game Boy, it has certain restrictions in terms of how low res it is and all that. And I think they're very wise to avoid, like, having some humongous, super detailed relative to the time sprite for the Game Boy that would have, you know, taken up a huge part of the screen's real estate.
Yeah, who'd be dumb enough to do that?
And thus create virtually no visibility, like Metroid 2. I think there was a Konami Turtles game that was very guilty of that as well.
Mario Land 2 is kind of borderline for having too large of a character.
Mario Land 2 is maybe a little borderline, and it's kind of a bit slower to compensate. And I mean, with this, in terms of the size of the sprite, you know, it's not too big or anything, but because of the kind of gameplay, where you're kind of swinging across, you know, sometimes some larger kind of areas towards the end where it's getting trickier, it's still something of an issue. But, you know, most of the game, it's not really a problem. I think actually it's probably, compared to Rearmed, it seemed quite a bit easier. Most of the game, I guess, it's probably not as many enemies on screen and all that kind of stuff. And maybe they did tone it down a little bit, knowing that it would be tough to have like really elaborate layouts over broad spaces because of, you know, this visibility issue. So it generally feels you're pretty correct, and the actual swinging mechanic is very well represented. It feels right. I took to it really quite quickly again, because it feels faithful, even though it is somewhat different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some issues, like the commando-like top-down bits.
Yeah.
They're out, actually. They're gone altogether. They're sort of replaced with a bit... It's a bit like the bits in Gargoyle's Quest, where you just sort of get a few enemies to kill, except they're longer, there's a few more screens. And you can actually kind of abuse those sections to grind for continues. Like, there's certain enemies in them that if you kill them, you get an extra continue, and therefore you can get quite a lot of extra continues.
That's very old NES game, like the ones that would be 38 levels and you get 3 lives total, but you could grind for continues in one place in the second floor.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could end up, it seems that for, I think it's like, you know, 3 lives, 3 continues, but as it turns out, you know, there are some extra lives hidden around, but continues are very much more easy to find. And what also happens is you start off with like a health bar of 3 chunks, but as you kill enemies and they leave behind these like little bullet casings or whatever.
They're pills. Come on. Everybody knows they're magical pills.
That you start expanding your health bar pretty quickly, and so it gets quite long, and you could take quite a lot of hits. And I mean, one of the things that's definitely significantly inferior to Rearmed is the bosses, you know, the end of the levels. There's not a lot of variety. You usually just get towards the end, and there'll be like one enemy sort of guarding this little fortressy thing that you have to shoot down, and sometimes you could just pretty much ignore that enemy and just shoot it, and nothing much happens. And then other times that enemy will be more of a significant impediment, but there's never really that much going on with those bits. So the primary focus is just the platforming, such as it is with the grappling. But the really doesn't get that tough until the very end. There's a part where you're actually like swinging along the underside of the Albatross, and there's like, you know, these engines firing and all this. I was like, wow, this is really quite hard. It's got like they kind of waited on that to spring that on you. And in that case, I will say that was one element where I wanted to use the save state, because I could not imagine, you know, the amount of times that it took me to get that right.
Hundreds, I'm sure.
It was a lot, and I could not imagine like playing all the way up to that bit just to get the opportunity to fail it.
Oh, then you could not imagine beating Ninja Gaiden for NES.
Well, I've got very close to beating Ninja Gaiden without a save state, yeah, but I haven't actually done it, so right. That's point taken, yeah. Exactly.
A lot of people have almost beaten Ninja Gaiden on NES.
But it's not dissimilar with Ninja Gaiden, because the thing that's a real problematic about that is you kind of restart at certain points for a while, but then if you run out of lives, then you go all the way back to the start of that final level. That's what kills it. That's what makes it a much more difficult.
Also, it makes you beat about 8 bosses in a row.
Yeah, you can't just focus on that final section so much then, and so it gets trickier to sort of learn. I suppose it's sort of similar here. That was the one case where it's like, no, I'm close to the end. I'm not going to put myself through going up to that point a lot of time. I mean, there's probably a few cases, you know, earlier on where you could have gone that way in terms of, you know, there's some tricky sections that kind of stack on top of each other that you could split up essentially by using the save state. I'm sure that probably helped some people finish it, but I didn't find it too tough until that very, very last bit, which, you know, is understandable. It is the very end of the game.
It sounds like it's kind of like a map pack for NES Bionic Commando, which sounds pretty good to me.
It's a kind of a remix in large part, but I think there's a few conveniences and enhancements as well in terms of there's more dialogue, I think, that's a bit more cogent by the sound of it from what I've heard about.
Are you suggesting NES writing wasn't good?
It doesn't go like all the way into like Rearmed, where it became, you know, self-aware and ironic and all that kind of stuff, but it does at least sort of make somewhat more sense. And also there's some conveniences, like I think when you go into like a Cobb's room, you know, which you need to open a door or whatever, and you brought the wrong receiver, for instance, you can actually just switch the receiver then and there to the correct one, so that you can then successfully communicate with home base or whatever and then open the door, which I'm not sure you could do in the NES one.
I know, you had to leave the stage, usually by dying, and then switch it in the menu before you came in, because you could only carry one item, like one kind of special weapon, which you sometimes need to get over obstacles. So you could choose only one special weapon and one receiver And if you pick the wrong ones, too bad.
Yeah, well, it's similar here in terms of you have to make those decisions before you begin the level, but then if you're in a comms room, then you have another chance to pick what you want.
It's very easy to choose the wrong color receiver on a black and white game.
Yeah, they're just sort of different shapes now. I guess that's different too. But and then the other thing is the music. I didn't play with the sound on that often, but when I did, it sounded pretty cool. I think I recognized a certain amount of stuff that probably came from the NES game and then got remixed with Rearmed. But I think there's also some original music in it too. And as you'd expect from Capcom, it sounds really good. So, yeah, I mean, if for any reason this is kind of your only way to experience Bionic Commando, because perhaps you don't have a console that can play Rearmed or something, then I would really, really recommend looking into it if you think you could enjoy this kind of, you know, it's a very particular kind of game because it's platforming without jumping, essentially. So I imagine it could be frustrating for some people, but once you get into it, yeah, and you start sort of doing it second nature and then ultimately doing some really, really tricky stuff, it's very rewarding as a result.
You could have just been describing VVVVVV.
Yeah, I'd thought of that, actually, which is not out in Europe, by the way, if you're wondering why I have not been speaking about that. Well, it's Nicholas, isn't it? I mean, we're very familiar at this point with the track record. You know, Cave Story for WiiWare was on a massive lag. Cave Story for DSiWare still isn't out.
It's coming.
They failed certification recently, apparently, on some error in the manual or something. Anything Nicholas on the downloadable platforms, better be prepared to wait if you're European. Man. But yeah, oh yeah, exactly. This kind of gameplay appeals to me a lot, and so I'll be all over VVVVVV when it does emerge.
You could buy it for your computer for about $2.
Yeah, I know, but I just don't play games on my computer at all. I'd much rather do it on 3DS.
This computer is all for business.
Well, I don't think Bionic Commando is out on the American eShop yet, but I might pick it up when it does come out, because it'll probably be $3 or $4, and that sounds like it'll be worth my time. But I'm really waiting for Elite Forces, which is the Game Boy Color game that Nintendo Software Technologies made. And John, I know you're a fan as well.
Yep.
Well, Game Boy Color games starting to show up, you know, with some frequency now, yeah. So perhaps it won't necessarily be as long away as we might have thought.
Now, what scares me is if they bring out Crystalis, because that Game Boy Color version is horrible. And it's going to be hard for me to look at it on the eShop and not buy it, but then I just have to remember what it was like playing it.
So obviously, I mean, those two games are joined together because they're both NST Game Boy Color versions.
Yeah, they came out very close together, too, as I recall.
Yeah, they came. I think they were in the same Nintendo Power, actually. It was weird.
But Crystalis is a port, albeit a bad one, but yes. Elite Forces...
Oh, it's a completely original game. Completely original Bionic Commando game. It is hard as balls. It looks really good. Good music. It is what if Nintendo's C-Team made their own Bionic Commando game. And it's really good.
So it wouldn't be redundant to have it with this Bionic Commando game, because this is sort of a remix of the original version. To then just have a straight remake would be pointless. But yeah, no, yeah. I'd be interested. More Bionic Commando is fine by me.
Yeah, no, Elite Forces is a completely original game. All right, James, well, your chance to wrap up new business.
Yeah, I got a little bit of pieces going around here. So I knocked out Deus Ex this week, and I not complained, but noted last week that it's not super stealthy. It's not. You can't really be super shooty either. Some people in the forum said, "Oh, my sixth playthrough, I was able to go through it all stealth." I'm like, "Yeah, well, on your sixth, you were able to do that." So yeah.
Once I memorized where all the enemies were, it was fairly easy to sneak around them.
It's like, dude, this is like a 15-hour game or more. There won't be a sixth playthrough for me. There might be a second. But I actually was kind of shocked at the end of the game. Not story-wise, although the story ending was pretty bizarre, is that it actually really changes how the game plays at the very end, because it goes from, up until that point, you've been going through densely defended territory, and then you go through this weird stretch of where it feels like a survival horror game, because there's a lot of emptiness and creepiness, but there's none of the monsters jumping out and killing you. So it spends the last hour of the game making you completely horrified of nothing, which is not an experience I've had in a game for a long time. It does end on kind of a weird non-bang that still resonates, so I don't know. It's a fun game. I do advise people play it, but it's a different experience, and I have a hard time putting it in perspective against many other titles because it is kind of its own thing.
Yeah, I'll probably pick up a cheap Steam copy.
So I have another 360 game that I got on that same sale, and that was L.A. Noire. I basically have just put it in and not done much with it, so we're going to let that sit for maybe a couple weeks because it is a big game.
Yeah, I might try to play some of it between now and then, so maybe we could double up on it, James.
So what I have played a bit of is one of the games from the Ambassador series of F-Zero Maximum Velocity Advanced Wars Dual Strike 2, whatever you want to call it. The non-anime-inspired GBA F-Zero game.
This was the launch, so basically a launch title. I think it was one of the first GBA games that I played.
Oh yeah, it was the first that I played that well, that in Castlevania.
I mean, straight out, this is a Super Nintendo game.
It's got two layers of Mode 7, though.
Mm. It does have two layers.
It's twice the game of the other one.
When I put it in there, I thought, you know, if the first F-Zero game you played was X, you would think, what the F is this?
Oh, yeah.
It's funny, you know, with this one, there's this common thread between F-Zero Maximum Velocity and Mario Kart Super Circuit in that, obviously, they kind of went backwards a little bit because they had to go back to the Mode 7 style after they'd gone fully polygonal on N64. But for me, when I played them at the time, it was the same year, I think, that they came out back in 2001. You know, I really got into them. Played them to death despite the visibility problems and all that kind of stuff, but I've never been able to go back to them very successfully because I just find the handling styles is actually really quite different even from their counterparts on the Super Nintendo. I just find even just steering is a bit foreign to me. Like with F-Zero Maximum Velocity in particular, I have very vivid memories of really having a feather that accelerator just to make any turn in the game.
Right, and they tell you that, but it is literally, you almost cannot make any turns in that game without hammering up and down on the A button.
Yes, and I missed that when I was first starting, and I literally blew up on the first race of the easiest circuit.
Oh, the game's totally unplayable if you don't learn that technique, and I'm not really a fan of that because I think the game looks nice and it's still fun to play, but the original F-Zero doesn't have you randomly mashing the button to go around turns. Okay?
You don't have to masturbate the accelerator in that game. Yeah. It's just, you just go. But what's funny is there's these shoulder steering buttons that effectively do nothing. I mean, they're not helpful.
Yeah, that's the banking was a big part of the Super Nintendo game. In some ways, it kind of almost showed off the shoulder buttons in a way.
And it adds a lot of nuance to the controls in the original F-Zero. And it's something you really have to master the use of. In Maximum Velocity, I feel like they've actually made a game in which all of the vehicles are about three times faster than they should be to go around those track designs. So the only way for them to make the game playable is to tell you to play at far less than top speed.
The maximum velocity?
It's just strange, because don't forget, the GBA was adding shoulder buttons too. I mean, that's all it was. Yeah. It didn't have extra face buttons either, so it is odd that they're not as pivotal. Especially as James said, you know, you're thinking, as many games on the GBA were, you know, let's just work off the Super Nintendo template, it's a launch game, all this kind of stuff. It's interesting that they actually did make that change, maybe because they didn't want it to be redundant, I don't know. But once I got into it, it would still be fatiguing, if you're trying to do a cup on one of the harder difficulties, that's for sure. But I did, once I got into it, I established very dependable techniques and I did everything on the master and all that, but I can never go back to it. It's too much of a barrier to entry. So yep. I was wondering if you've experienced much the same thing.
Oh God, yes. So my first observation, once I stopped exploding and I realized I had to go, and as opposed to just A, was that rule doesn't apply to the AI in the slightest. And they literally take turns like they're on rails. And like they all will follow the exact same line through a turn. And if they hit anything, they immediately recover, whereas you bounce back and forth for an hour.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things, though, about the old school F-Zero games is how explosive your crap outs are. Especially the original, and you would go like really fast, like with the boost or something, and you got clipped, and you just, you know, the whole screen spinning and you're bouncing back and forth between those electrified edges and you blow up. You know, it's so harsh in that way.
Yeah.
But it's very exciting when that doesn't happen. You know, if you try something risky and you do it, you know, it's not like Lakitu's not going to come and fish you out. You know, you are dead.
Well, what amused me was I'm going around, so I'm about to win the third or fourth race, so I'll have like four first places in a row. I was thinking, I've got this game. I get clipped on the last lap by two, you know, just tapped. I bounce around seven or eight times and blow up. He recovers after one bounce and just shoots through the finish line. I'm like, you know what? Fuck you, game. Really. I don't need this from you.
Yeah, I'm looking at my review of the game, which is now over a decade old.
Nice.
And I gave it a 7.5. Yeah. I gave it a 7.5. I mean, this was one of the first reviews we ever posted, you know, because it was a GBA launch title. So this is from July 13th, 2001. And I complained a lot about the difficulty. Just said it's extremely hard. And basically, you know, I got to the master level and just gave up. And
the thing is, I mean, some people would say, well, F-Zero games, aren't they all really hard? And most of them are. I think F-Zero X is significantly easier than the others.
Well, yeah, GX is insidious.
Yeah, GX is very hard, but GX is much more playable.
Right, and it's much more fair.
It's more fair, right.
It's hard, but it's fair. I mean, the bullshit in some of those story levels, that might be marginally fair.
Well, I haven't tried to play it on my 3DS, but
you should. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I should. But it's sad to hear you guys say that it's hard to go back to, because I think the original F-Zero for Super Nintendo is easy to go back to. I mean, I have that on Virtual Console on the Wii, and it's great.
Well, it's like the original Super Mario Kart's easy to go back to, but Super Circuit isn't. It's the same thing. I don't know what it is about the way they approached, at the one hand, going back to those templates, but not going all the way back, like changing them somewhat, somehow just made them.
I would say that the GBA, for a while, had some really weird, janky stuff going on with their games. I mean, some of the straight Super Nintendo ports are weird because of the lack of four buttons.
Yeah, four buttons, and also the screen real estate could be an issue because it's low res.
But some of the games that were modeled on Super Nintendo games feel really strange. And I'm going to be curious going through the rest of what games they put out for the service, because although they've never, quote, confirmed GBA games, but they're coming. It's going to happen. I'll be curious if they avoid these weird double ports, or I guess they'd be triple ports at that point. Because I always felt like when I played those on the Game Boy Advance, it never quite felt right. And playing this game now, even though it was built for the Game Boy Advance, it just doesn't quite feel right. It's that same feeling of, this just isn't quite right. Something's not complete here. I'm getting a less than the original experience, even though I am getting, technically speaking, the original experience. I don't know. It's a lot of later GBA games, games that were brand new, conceptually conceived for the system. I don't get that feeling.
It's one thing I've always been interested in, though, is obviously there were another two GBA F-Zero games.
Yeah, the anime ones.
And one of them came out outside of Japan. I've always wondered, did they change that whole technique, or, you know, how much did they get closer to the Super Nintendo games? Because I've never played them.
So weirdly, at a Circuit City, which kind of dates this, they had a demo unit with the GBA set up. The anime game was in one of those GBAs. It was the demo game. I don't know why. Maybe it was just a quiet time for the GBA, but that was the game that was there. And I remember playing it, and I hadn't dealt with Maximum Velocity's weirdness, but it felt pretty arcadey.
More immediate then, really.
Yeah, like it felt more approachable as a game. More I could pick this game up and start playing it and not have to spend four races going, why am I always crashing?
I remember hearing that the third one, the one that stayed in Japan, was not good. I remember hearing that. I think they handed it off to, you know, some kind of no-name developer, and it was yet another, you know, it was kind of timed for the new season of the F-Zero anime that never came over either, and
yeah,
it just sounded like...
Remember when there were too many F-Zero games?
I know.
Ah, those were the days.
Basically, from 2001 to, like, 2004, that was true.
There were about five of them.
GP Legend is the anime game.
Yeah.
Well, F-Zero Climax is the one that stayed in Japan.
Because of the name, probably.
Exactly.
We had three on GBA, one on GameCube, and one in the arcade. So we had five F-Zero games in the span of about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Then someone probably got fired for making all of them, and there you go.
Why are you making all of these games?
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
And that was the end of that, and that's the end of this segment.
Oh, is it?
Nice.
Do we want to discuss the Resident Evil demo first?
Sure.
Have you played it?
I have played it.
I have not, James. I have not played it. I can confirm that.
No way.
Or a 3DS, ever. So I just played it. It's kind of a weird feeling playing that game. So this is the E3 demo again. So you can go back to our comments from when we played it there.
Yeah.
But I'm really, really curious about playing this with the Circle Pad Pro.
Well, I might be able to help you out there, James, next week.
Ooh, oh, that's right. Yes.
I have foregone the opportunity to play the demo because A, I played it already, as you've alluded to, when they brought over the E3 stuff for the event in the consecrated church in London last year.
Yes.
It's coming out next week. Hopefully by the show, with a bit of expeditious shipping, next week's show, I'll have it by then. But one of the retailers over here online had an exclusive deal where you got the Circle Pad Pro bundle for cheaper than the cheapest price for the standalone game.
What?
Wow.
So they were basically giving it away. So despite the fact that
they were paying you to take it.
No real enthusiasm for the Circle Pad Pro at this point. I may as well, and never know. Could come in handy. So hopefully I'll be able to report on what it does or does not add to the controls of the game. But I mean, some of the early reviews I've read suggest it is perhaps somewhat helpful, especially if you're one of these people that's very used to controlling this kind of third-person action game on a console, but it's not really necessary at all or anything. They think the standard controls do still work quite well. Mm-hmm. So I'm not concerned about having to use it or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had more time to adjust to it, I'd probably be okay. But it's kind of weird feeling right now. Like, I just kind of, as I'm playing it, go like, this still feels a bit like I'm being a bit held down. Like, it's not that they're not workable. It's just everything feels a bit slow.
Is this your first time playing Resident Evil?
No. No,
That's just how Resident Evil controls.
No, it's not, though. I mean, Resident Evil 4 feels faster than this game. I mean, it just does. Like, you're moving faster. You're able to position yourself faster. You can react faster. This game feels a little bit slow.
Hmm. Yeah, that could be intentional. It could be a technology thing. I don't know. I mean, I don't disagree with you, but it's also kind of hard to say based on the demo. So I'll reserve judgment on that aspect of it. I mean, this was my game of E3, and the demo this seems to be pretty much the same demo. There might be a couple extra features you can turn on and off, but I think it looks amazing. It sounds really great if you turn the sound up, and I'm pretty excited about the game. I guess my... to me, I didn't like 5 very much, but Resident Evil 4 is one of my all-time favorite games, and the thing that blew me away was sort of the scale of it, just the scope of the game. It ended up being so much more epic and inventive over a very long period of time than I would have ever expected from this series before that, and that's kind of what I'm looking for here. I'm not necessarily expecting a 20-hour game, but I would like it to feel like you really make a journey here, like you move through different environments and you really accomplish something and you really...
Yeah, that's very... I mean, you couldn't argue with that in 4. Definitely had the variety of places that you went to really surprised me. I was not expecting... I didn't really read up that much on RE4. I didn't have to. The praise was so overwhelming. You didn't really have to get into the minutiae of the reviews to think that it was worth playing. And so it was very fresh when I played it, and I was really surprised, based on the previous installments, how much of a journey you went on. With this, it seems like it will be a bit different, but some of it's the structure. Like, it seems like you're going to have the recurring location of the ship, the Zenobia, whatever it is, at sea, where you're kind of going to have some of that haunted house thing that goes back to the original Resident Evil, but then you're going to have these kind of episodes on the side with other characters. I don't know whether some of them are like flashbacks or they're happening at the same time, but, elsewhere.
It does feel a bit weird like that.
So you are going to see other locations. You know, you're not just going to be sort of stuck on the ship. And I don't suppose they could fit an underground laboratory in a ship. But, you know, you will get to see other stuff.
Only so, in 999.
I don't know whether you'll get quite the same sets, though. I'd be surprised if you did, because that was very strong in RE4. It's tough to match at the best of times.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it was all interconnected, I think, made a big difference. I think if they're just bouncing you around different places, you don't feel like you went on a journey. You just feel like you saw different places.
And that could be good enough. I mean, that could be fine.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, one of my big problems with the first couple of Resident Evil games that I played is that they do feel pretty confined. You know, they're very samey environments.
Well, the big problem with those games is they're terrible.
Yeah.
And anyone who says otherwise is wrong.
All right. So now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with Kid Icarus Uprising, our latest round of hands-on impressions from Aaron Kaluska with Sakurai's killer app for the 3DS stand.
Yeah. Completely insane, yet entirely required.
Yes. On the review front, we have a review of Samurai Sword Destiny by Zachary Miller on the 3DS eShop. He says it's part hack and slash, part roguelike, all tedious. And also another review by Danny Bivens, Beyblade Metal Masters. And Danny says that his ultimate ambition is to bring back the dinosaurs.
I'm amazed they're still making Beyblade games. I reviewed one for GBA.
Yeah.
It's an anime about kids spinning tops at each other.
Well, remember, they still make Yu-Gi-Oh games, and those were on the Game Boy Color. We have a preview of Tekken 3D Prime Edition by Nate Andrews. It's a Tekken game on the 3DS.
Yo, I heard it's pretty good.
Tekken games tend to be pretty good if you're a 3D fighting fan. We also have a preview, this time for the Wii, of Rhythm Heaven Fever by Pedro Hernandez. You can learn all there is to know about the latest Rhythm Heaven game if by chance you miss Greg talking about it on the show.
Alright, and finally we have an Extra Life by Pedro Hernandez on Super Adventure Island. Extra Life is a feature where our staff members go back and write an article about one of their favorite games from yesteryear. And in this one, Pedro dons a red cap and a grass skirt as he returns to a series that he loves very dearly.
Picture or it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
I actually believe Pedro Hernandez lives on a Super Adventure Island.
I don't know if I'd call Puerto Rico a Super Adventure Island, but...
Yes, so all of this original content is over at NintendoWorldReport.com along with our daily news updates, and there has been a lot of crazy news lately, so be sure to head over there every day and check out the latest and greatest about Nintendo. You know, every so often we like to read emails here on the show, and that's what we're going to do this week. We always get some interesting questions and topics from our listeners, and you can send yours to the address rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I will repeat it later, so grab a pen and paper. Until then, the first letter comes from Ken. I was listening to RFN 272, and James mentioned that it's less of an impulse buy when you play a demo of a retail game as compared to a downloadable game's demo. So I was thinking, as Nintendo leads the way in online innovation, say they actually...
They lead a way in online innovation.
Lead away from...
They lead it to somewhere. Somewhere else.
Say they actually brought retail game demos to the eShop.
Done.
Wouldn't it be to retailers' advantage to work with Nintendo or anyone else to offer a link, Amazon Games comes to mind, allowing you to order the retail game online from your system? That would not allow time for a person to lose the feeling that made them want to buy the game. I could see Amazon wanting that piece of the pie, but Nintendo seems to be in bed with GameStop, so maybe a deal with them instead. There's also the insane idea of allowing a retail game to download on your system, say overnight while it sleeps and charges. But you guys already said Nintendo won't allow that. So obviously Ken wrote this email before it was announced that the Resident Evil demo would be coming to the eShop after all. But now that it has happened, against all odds, It is interesting that, number one, the game is not out yet, so it is a preview demo, which at the consumer level doesn't happen. Well, it happens sometimes, but not always, even on systems where you get a lot of demos.
Right, a lot of times it's day and date demos.
Yeah, or even sometimes they release demos months later after the game comes out.
Yeah, I think they did that with Darksiders, didn't they? Or there was a different one that was just a dungeon. It was this huge section of the game that they just sliced out, and that was a bit of a different approach. But it worked on me, actually.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, now we do have a demo, which to me is interesting that we have a demo of a retail game before we've had any demos of downloadable games. And there's no indication on the horizon that Nintendo's going to be putting demos of downloadable games on the eShop. Although, when you look at the fact that they have done it for WiiWare, it seems inevitable that it will also happen for the eShop games eventually. And maybe it's just right now there just aren't enough eShop games out there to really try to push that kind of support. I don't know.
But the other distinction to make, of course, is that all these demos, as far as I can recall, in Japan, and the ones that have been announced in Europe, are third-party games, of course, in terms of Nintendo's concern in this. You know, it seems like perhaps this is something that their partners, particularly in Japan, you know, people like Capcom especially, but not limited to them, have perhaps asked for. And so, you know, they've made it possible, but it just doesn't necessarily seem like it's something that Nintendo themselves is all that eager to do.
Well, I mean, Nintendo doesn't, it's going to be a little while before Nintendo has a first-party game coming out on 3DS, so, you know, let's not count them out yet. I mean, I think they could very well do a demo for Kid Icarus, although I don't think they should.
The demos that exist in Japan, for instance, are quite a few of them go backwards. So Dead or Alive, for instance, has a demo. So I mean, you could have had a demo for Nintendogs or Steel Diver or Ocarina of Time or, you know, all this kind of stuff from earlier in the 3DS's life. You know, perhaps if a lot, obviously we know in Japan a lot of people have bought them recently, some of those demos could have been a nice little remarketed tool to go, well, there are these games that came out before you bought the system.
Mm-hmm. And they were either ports or terrible.
Well, Nintendo probably wouldn't look at it that way. You know, a demo could have served that purpose, but they haven't gone that way. It does seem like it's really driven by the third parties. I know, in terms of some of the ones that are coming up here, you've got Cooking Mama, you've got Rhythm Thief. You know, it's not Nintendo.
Right. Sega announced two, actually. They announced Rhythm Thief and Sonic at the Olympics. And so Mario and Sonic at the Olympics is both Europe and North America, but only Europe is getting Rhythm Thief, which is completely backwards, because once you put Mario and Sonic in the Olympics in people's hands, they'll realize it's the worst game ever made.
Well, to revisit the gist of Ken's question here, what do you guys think about this idea of letting people take advantage of the immediacy of having just played a demo for a retail game and providing them some way to then connect that to their wallet, since they can't download the retail game to their system right away?
I don't see how it would hurt.
It's an interesting idea, because it goes back to our conversation last week about sometimes you're struggling to get around to playing games or finishing games. It's from a behavioral point of view, same exact thing with purchasing stuff. If you can remove as many sort of frictions and barriers to that impulse of buying something, actually translating to buying it, that's good. But the problem I see in this is, you know, in terms of Nintendo forging a partnership to say, okay, well, you know, this retailer gets to be the one that we link to in some very easy way, you know, sort of jump-starting off the back of the demos. First of all, could get sticky with other retailers. You could end up pissing people off. That's a bit of an issue. But also, as I say, if Nintendo themselves is not really fully invested in this because they're not even putting their own games on it, I'm not sure that they would get in the process of negotiating with retailers
on behalf of other publishers.
This is the issue, where they're not fully invested. I mean, on the one hand, it's nice that they're sort of providing the venue, given that apparently they don't really see that it would necessarily accrue, you know, instant benefits for themselves. It's good that they've done it, but at the same time, it suggests that there's very limited scope to it as well.
Yeah, but don't forget, on the Wii Nintendo channel, they do have these kinds of links. If you search for the trailer of a game, you know, you'll watch the video on your Wii, you can click a button down there to find more information, and it will actually provide links to Amazon and to GameStop and to whatever. I don't know what all is listed there, and maybe it updates over time. I'm not sure, but they do provide that. And the problem on Wii, which is the same problem that you'd have on 3DS, is that it's just going to open up the crappy browser. So I think the way to do this, this could be very successful. I mean, Ken's idea has a lot of merit, obviously, but the way to do it is to integrate that into the eShop so that you can actually pre-order a game from within the eShop and maybe just choose the retailer that you want to pick it up at, without having you open up a web browser and, you know, start to enter a bunch of fields with your awful soft keyboard and, you know, et cetera.
Here's where I see the rub, though, is that this makes a lot more sense for download games, because ultimately you're paying to unlock the experience right now. It's got this, I want to keep playing this game on this sitting, versus this we're saying, I want to keep playing this game in 3 to 5 days.
Well, yes.
There's still a difference, yeah.
And also with downloadable games, Nintendo is the retailer, so you remove that weird thing from the equation.
I mean, there's a big distinction there, obviously. It's like, hey, you can play the game now, because a lot of times these demos end on what are essentially like cliffhanger moments. So it's like, hey. Yeah.
If they're well designed, they do. I mean.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Monster Hunter.
In the case of Resident Evil, it just kind of clicks off when you reach a certain time limit.
Yeah, well, yeah, John's Monster Hunter example is fantastic.
Monster Hunter Wii, the worst demo I've ever played.
Yeah. Oh my god, what happened in that demo? Yeah, I mean, it's hard for these disc-based games, because I feel like you almost have to design your demo differently. I feel like on a disc-based game, you should design the demo to be kind of a freestanding experience. Not because you want somebody to say, okay, I've had enough with the game, but just so they feel like they get the whole arc of this little mini story they're doing.
Yeah.
Not necessarily an actual story, but like this experience. Whereas in a download demo where you have a turnkey operation.
It's better, it almost becomes pay to continue, insert coin.
Right. Yeah, it's very arcade-like. I feel like the way to design it is almost exactly like Greg's saying. It's like Gauntlet Legends when you just ran out of food. And you're like, the final boss is right there.
I think the interesting thing about Ken's idea, going back to that, it's almost like a kind of intermediate step. I mean, obviously, we all know eventually digital is going to move into the space where it's not going to be sort of confined to smaller games and all this kind of stuff. And so this is kind of like a short-term kind of fix for that problem while retail is still so important, as it will continue to be for a number of years to come yet. And in some ways, that applies most to Nintendo, doesn't it? I mean, that's what we always talk about, that, you know, they're probably going to be the last to have their retail games transition over to digital downloads. And whereas, you know, I'm not sure that this is necessarily something that would ever happen in the short term, as I said, because they're not necessarily that invested in it. And I don't think, as Johnny said, the real way is to integrate it into the eShop, but they're not going to rewrite the eShop to accommodate this sort of functionality for games that aren't even theirs. If they're not even demoing their own games. But in the future, I think it might be the sort of thing that they might do while Sony and Microsoft are going more fully headlong into the digital age, as it were.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it is one of the most interesting things to me about the Vita coming out here in really in just a couple of weeks now. The fact that all the games that come out on Vita come out digitally as well as at retail, and we assume, I don't know that we've confirmed this yet, but it's certainly in Japan, the games are cheaper if you download them versus buying them in the store. And I think that provides a really interesting incentive to users who might otherwise not really consider buying games through the online store. But if Sony's marketing is clever and they make it clear to people that there is an advantage to doing so, that you will save dollars if you download your games versus going to the store, they could really start to kind of shift people towards that mentality of getting used to doing that, especially on a self-contained gaming platform. Now, I know people are screaming about iPhone and stuff like that, but this is a really very different kind of model here. You're talking about not spending a dollar or two, but $50, you know, $40, $50 to download a game to your Vita. And if they can actually convince people to do that over time, if they're clever about it and they find ways to make that compelling, I think it will really start to set up not only the marketplace for 3DS and even the successor to 3DS or whatever to do that as well.
60S. But
I think it could actually be the Trojan horse for consoles to do that as well. And to be fair, PS3 and 360 already sell full retail games over over their digital stores, but not day and date, and they certainly don't sell them at a discount at the same time that the retail version is out. So I think the Vita, even though I don't think it's going to be a huge success this year, but I do think it could sort of start to change the general public consensus about how these things should work, and that there's really no reason for you to pre-order a game at a store and then get in your car and drive there and pick it up and take it home and play it when you could have just sat on the toilet and done that whole thing without ever talking to another human being and save $10 doing it that way.
Well, the other thing, though, that raises the question is just the amount of money involved. I mean, it will never be quite such an easy thing to do, even if it were just, you know, insert coin. When that coin amounts to the value of $50, I think people are always probably going to be a little bit more reticent to just do it purely on impulse. So maybe there's some, from a behavioral point of view, there are limits to what can be achieved by just getting rid of these little impediments, because the psychological impediment of just, hang on a minute, do I actually want to spend this much money?
I agree with you, Greg, but at the same time, it's much easier to spend $50 through an online store than it is to dish out $50 in cash, or even to pull out your credit card and have somebody swipe it. So it doesn't feel like it's as much money when you spend it over the internet.
It's true.
And also, I think, you know, if you're sitting at the end of a retail demo and you're being offered the chance to buy the game, you're never going to be in a better informed position to make that decision. I mean, it is, yes, they are trying to get you to make an impulse decision, but you just played the game. Like, and you're sitting there thinking, do I want to play more of this? Well, I think you're in a pretty educated position there to say yes or no.
About that game, yes. But then you may also think, but hang on a minute, if I've got a limited budget, I haven't played this, that, and the other game yet. I haven't checked online to see if this has come down in price or that's good. You know, if $50 at that particular point is a big chunk of what you have to spend on gaming for a period of X number of weeks, it's not enough to just think, well, I enjoyed that, so I'll buy it. You've got to be confident that it's going to be the best possible use of that $50. You're getting into opportunity costs and all that sort of thing.
But what you're describing is the opposite of an impulse purchase.
Exactly, but that's my point, is that there are limits to how much of an impulse purchase you can make something that is $50.
Right.
No matter how smooth you make it, no matter how much you grease the wheels,
there's going to be a moment where you go, ooh.
Most people that are careful with their money or have a very limited amount of it are going to have to stop and think about it for a bit longer. So,
well, the good news is you have 29 more chances to play through that demo, but if you want to revisit your opportunity.
I think it was 3 in the case of Ace Combat.
All right, let's move on to the next letter, John.
All right, the next one. Jamie, a.k.a. Poke Squadron, writes, last year was Zelda's 25th anniversary. The year before was Mario's 25th anniversary. In 2012, it is Mega Man's turn. Taking into account that Capcom heavily celebrated Mega Man's 20th anniversary 5 years ago, what would you like to see from them regarding his 25th anniversary? What, in your mind, is an appropriate way of celebrating the history of a video game character in general? Would you like a compiled list of games, a soundtrack, behind-the-scenes footage? Do you even care about these anniversaries?
I don't know if there's any behind-the-scenes footage from the old Mega Man games. It was like 5 guys in a shed. I mean, it was
when he was like a male prostitute or something, like behind the scenes, like after before they picked him up off the street.
Like behind the scenes of his temper tantrums at Capcom around the 20th anniversary when he got mad at dealing with them. I mean, what do you want?
I think, I mean, to be fair, with the Mario 25th package, in some ways, the most unique thing about it was that booklet that was pretty bad, but, you know, it had some little sketches and stuff.
No, the audacity was the most unique thing about it.
They had some little sketches and designs and stuff that dated back to the time. That's kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah, I guess. But, I mean, Capcom's really exploited the Mega Man franchise sufficiently over the last...
Well,
always.
It seems like it's got really quiet, hasn't it? Obviously, Mega Man Legends 3's unfortunate fate. And
if they wanted to make me happy for the 25th anniversary, uncancel that game. I mean, that would make me happy.
Not happening.
No, it's not, but it would make me happy.
You look at the different ways they've been, you know, because of the timing in terms of, you think of the NES becoming a phenomenon and all that. Obviously, there's a lot of major anniversaries that have been going on in the last couple of years. Mario, yeah, they didn't really do a great job with that one. They released some limited edition stuff, didn't they? A DSi and an XL and like and the Wii. I guess you had the Red Wii. But there wasn't an actual lot of good content or anything. Zelda was definitely much better.
Yeah.
There was a lot of different things you could associate. You had obviously the concerts.
I got my tickets.
Which started last year. The tour started now. You had the Four Swords and, you know, Link's Awakening. Obviously, kind of, that was going to happen anyway, but that was a kind of nice way to kick off the eShop and tying it into E3. You know, I mean, they did a really nice job. Ocarina, Skyward Sword. I mean, I think a lot of it was just sort of happy coincidence that these things were kind of converging during that year. But when you can tie it all together and give people like the CD that came with Skyward Sword and all that, I mean, it's really nice. I mean, it's not something that you would demand of Nintendo, but if they do something like that, I like it. And then on the flip side, did you know it was also Castlevania's 25th birthday last year?
So two franchises that have been sort of...
No, I really didn't, actually.
You should have. John, you would have if you came to the staff meetings where we discussed this.
But the fact of the matter is, Konami did not say boo about that, really, did they? I
mean, no, they really didn't.
You know, it just maybe if they'd had one Castlevania product launch that was happening anyway, they could have piggybacked some stuff onto it and then gone from there. But this is what happens. It's Metroid, of course, as well. It was 25th anniversary last year, and that got blanked.
Well, it's not really surprising from Nintendo that...
No, because they're the same publisher as that's doing all the Zelda stuff. But, you know, I mean, some of these series, they're not going to get the same kind of attention. Like I said, I think how much attention these publishers pay a lot of the time is going to be a bit of a happy accident. If a few things could kind of converge and they can tie it up in this thing, you know, I mean, I've got Mega Man ZX Advent, which came out at the 20th anniversary of Mega Man, and it's got a little Mega Man 20th.
It was given one despite having nothing to do with their plans for the 20th anniversary.
They're not going to force it, if you know what I mean. So it wouldn't surprise me if Capcom did very, very little for Mega Man. Although, I imagine they may do something. I think hasn't Svensson hinted at something?
Yeah.
No, I mean, he said they're going to do something and it's going to be, quote, cool. But Svensson also once told us that Mega Man Legends 3 was real, so...
I could see them putting something on, like, Xbox Live Arcade or something like that, like coming out with some kind of free downloadable thing. I could see them doing something.
No, John, this is Capcom. It won't be free.
It's tough, though, because they've already done...
it'll be $10.
I mean, stuff like Mega Man 9 and 10, you know, I mean, those games are perfect anniversary games, but they already exist. You know?
Yeah, I mean, they did the anniversary collection for X and the original Mega Man games, that for the 20th anniversary, and then they had the ill-fated GBA anniversary that never came out.
Oh, man, that thing was in release hell for so long.
I think it's still on a release schedule somewhere in Nintendo's list.
That would not surprise me.
Like, those were really good. I mean... that's not true. The Mega Man one, the original series one, had really janked controls on the GameCube, but they fixed it in the X one. So I actually really like playing the X games.
Yeah.
So that sort of shoots that angle because I've already killed that horse. So yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, they could say, all right, we're going to pump Mega Man games into the Virtual Console and related services.
Well, I mean, they've put a lot of them on there, but there's still some left.
Yeah, I mean, if they said, we're going to commit to get X2, X3, and every SNES Mega Man game on the service. And hell, they could even say we'll put Mega Man 64 out there, and we'll put Mega Man RPG or whatever you want to call it, Mega Man Legends on the PlayStation, and Legends 2 and whatever, and just say we're going to get them all out there for download.
The Mega Man Omnibus.
Every Mega Man game will be available for download by the end of the year. If they said that, I would be like, okay, you win.
Yeah, that would be cool. I think it would be better and potentially less money to be made, but I think it would be cooler if they just released a disc for all the systems that basically combined the Mega Man and Mega Man X collections and fixed the controls and everything and the music, and then also added all those other games you talked about. It's basically like every Mega Man game on a disc.
I you know, if you start squeezing in the two Power Battles games, you're going to start to run out of space.
They were already on the collection.
Only the first Power Battle game was. The second one wasn't. The Mega Man Kart Racer. I mean, there's some crazy Mega Man shit that never...
You know, I at this point, I don't think any of the stuff that we just mentioned is going to happen. I would be happy if they released a Mega Man game this year. That is the best way that they could celebrate this anniversary, is just release a Mega Man game.
It seems tough, doesn't it? Because you've got the situation 2 got cancelled because it wasn't just
right Mega Man Universe.
But it's like, how do you revive this series? Like you said, Greg, they've already done Mega Man 9 and 10, which were great, weird, you know, retro throwbacks to that series, like so literal and so faithful. They've already remade Mega Man and Mega Man X on the PSP. And so I just don't know what's left in the goodie bag for them to pull out and be like, here, fans.
Actually, I've got one. We discussed the collectionist, but I don't think they'd put every game on a disc. What if they just handpicked a game from each of the Mega Man series and put it on a disc?
Then everybody would complain about the one that they picked.
Yeah, well, fuck them.
That's absolutely...
So, I mean, this is kind of how I look at the Mega Man franchise, which, I mean, for me, this is one of my top three most sacred cows. Like, and if anybody comes in and starts messing with this franchise, I get really defensive. You know, I just went to the Mega Man official Mega Man website because I figured this is probably the most comprehensive place they're going to discuss it. So it's a Flash webpage, which kind of gives you an idea of its age. And it starts with this quick video showing like really quick still shots of the various evolutions of the Mega Man character in the franchise, which is cool. And then it jumps and it's Mega Man Star Force is the Mega Man logo on the front. And under the category of things you can get on there, because it's all Flash webpage, you can, under the Mega Downloads, the Mega Loads, because everything starts with Mega, under the Mega Loads section are AIM icons. So that tells you how long it's been since the Mega Man website I got updated. God help us. If I could get a job at Capcom, I would want to just be the Mega Man producer. Just go, no, stop what you're doing and go back and make that game. And then just scream at people until they made Mega Man X9.
And that's the correct answer, James. Mega Man X9. That's the correct answer to this question. That's what I want them to do, is make a Mega Man X9.
But see, I don't want it to look like a Super Nintendo game, because to me, the Mega Man X series really looked good when it made that 32-bit jump.
Yeah, but the games weren't as good. So, Greg...
No, you're wrong. X4 is very, very good.
Greg has the next letter.
So, Nathan from Florida writes... I felt compelled to write to you and ask you to give some attention to SOPA on your podcast. That's the acronym for Stop Online Piracy Act, is it, in the Congress?
Yes.
Or if the sanitary version is the Protect IP Act.
What are your feelings about the potential this bill has in limiting personal liberty, or to put it another way, invading privacy? And do you think Nintendo of America is being purposefully vague by taking their name off the support of this bill, but not coming out publicly against it? And finally, my New Year's resolution is to not buy another Wii game so I can use that money to save up for Wii U. But not to worry, I still have plenty to play in my backlog and I pre-ordered Xenoblade before the year's end. In which case, I'm not really seeing the powerful sacrifice that Nathan is making.
He'll have saved $0.
That's the best part.
I mean, Wrath of Heaven is, I think, very much worth buying. And if you're in America, waiting for it to come out. But other than that, I'm struggling.
And Rhythm Heaven wouldn't have really set you far back from your Wii U goals either. It's, what is it, $30 probably?
Yeah, $30. Yeah, exactly. It's budget conscious. So consider that, Nathan. Consider it.
So yeah, as far as SOPA thing, I mean, we just got through the protest day, Wikipedia blacking out. Someone asked me if NWR would black out for SOPA, and I said, what good would that do anyone?
No, it would not have been.
We lose readers and ad dollars, and we've convinced no one to do anything about it.
Yeah, it's all about the size of your audience.
I have to say, the Wikipedia move was actually very effective because, I mean,
yeah, it was.
It really got people pissed off and contacted their legislators. Now, I would like to say, though, that it also proved that Twitter is the playground of the dumbest people in the history of the world. There's a Twitter account called Herpderpedia, which just retweeted tweets of people who are incredible imbeciles, who said things, quote, like, why is the government taking Wikipedia from us? Oh my God, stupid Wikipedia is on strike. Why can't I do any research? Or, quote, who are these cunts that blacked out Wikipedia, and when is it coming back? Hashtag cunts.
Wow.
That's probably a British person.
Pretty aggressive language there.
I hope it was a British person, otherwise that person's really angry.
Welcome to the internet.
There's like 400 of these. It's beautiful. But, I mean, it really did. I mean, I think there were 5 or 6 legislators who were co-sponsors of these resolutions who pulled their name. So this was an effective event, because losing 6 co-sponsors is a big deal for an act.
At this point, it's not going to get passed. You know, they might try to refine it and go back to the drawing board, but it's one of the classic cases where, you know, I'm sorry, this doesn't have a whole lot to do with Nintendo, but it is a hot topic right now, and I'll just briefly explain the way the United States legislation works, which is that a very rich donor or lobbyist firm, in this case, the MPAA primarily, I'm sure they had a couple of cohorts.
The MPAA, the RIAA, the ESA was involved.
So yeah, a few powerful lobby groups spend a lot of money, and they basically write the bill themselves to be.
So they literally write the bill, actually.
Yeah, they write the bill. They make it as broad as and, you know, as far-reaching as possible, and they basically feed it to a gullible congressman or senator who says, "Okay, I will happily take your campaign donations and this completed bill that I can later take credit for, even though I had nothing to do with creating it, and I will sponsor it. And I'll even convince some of my friends who owe me political favors, and they'll sponsor it too," which just means that it kind of attaches some names and makes it more famous and makes it more likely to get pushed up the ladder to stuff that actually gets debated.
It gets deposited in a committee's list of things to handle, and oftentimes committee chairmen are the ones who get targeted by these groups because they determine what comes on the agenda in these committees, and then it gets pushed through committee because only about 6 or 7 people actually pay any attention to your average committee in Congress, and if it's a subcommittee, fuck that, the press isn't even there.
But the other thing is, of course, Chris Dodd,
former senator from Connecticut.
Yeah, former. He was quite an important. He ran for president last time.
Comedically,
the Democrat side. He is the head of the MPAA.
Yes, he is.
So, I mean, they've got a very direct conduit to the legislative process here, and so people would say that's why it overreaches, because it's written, you know, from very much one point of view. But go back to Nintendo's position. They're kind of trying to straddle both sides of it. On the one hand, obviously, you know, Nintendo's case, they have a very direct interest in killing this kind of piracy, because yes, it does cost them money. We've had plenty of conversations about, well, how much money does it cost them? You know, it's difficult. All the figures you get are probably inflated, because it supposes that everyone that downloads something would have bought it, which is transparently ridiculous. But still, it's undeniable that they would have lost a lot of money from piracy over the years. And so they want it, if they can be effectively legislated against so that it's, if not eradicated, significantly reduced, of course they want that to happen. But the other thing, that the other situation that Nintendo's in, is in a position where a lot of its biggest customers, a lot of its biggest fans, are people who are really sensitive to this kind of stuff, because they use the internet a lot.
Right, they're the internet power users.
They're active in online communities and all that. So, you know, on the one hand, they're worried about their bottom line, but on the other hand, they're worried about alienating some of their fans if they're too kind of vociferous in their support for something like this. It is a similar kind of line that a lot of people are actually having to walk. And so now we've got to the point where it seems like it's so obvious that it's not going to pass, that it's a lot easier for Nintendo to not feel like they have to lend a sort of obligatory bit of support or say this, that, and the other. They could pretty much just let it pass into the night, and presumably this will all start again once another version is written with something in the direction of addressing these concerns.
And really, what Nintendo's position here isn't, I mean, it's literally a non-position. What they have said is that the ESA, the Electronic Software Association, speaks on our behalf with respect to all legislative issues. So what they're literally saying is, don't come ask us about any specific policy issues. We're not going to give you a comment. Refer to these guys. We pay millions of dollars every year to do that for us.
Yes, they represent – essentially, the ESA are kind of like Nintendo's lawyers on a corporate level, on an industry level. You know, they represent them in all the way up to the Supreme Court, essentially. And did successfully earlier this year in a decision that I think most of us are very happy about, with free speech and censorship of video games. But one of the big problems with bills like this, and it's happened many times over the years, and I don't have to give you a lot of examples, but the people who are most affected by this bill don't actually know what's in the bill. They don't really know what it means. That's the thing. Nintendo didn't have a position on SOPA because they'd never read it. They pay someone else to do that for them, and that's the ESA. Right. The congressmen never read it because they don't have time because they vote on so many bills. So they rely on their 20-year-old staff members to do it for them or whatever. And in general, the congressmen don't really care what's in the bill. They care about whether their friends and supporters think they should vote on it or not. And if you notice, you know, they always name these bills as something that, like, who could be against stopping online piracy? Who could be against protecting intellectual property? You know, and so it sounds like a good thing that I can sell to my constituents when I go out and run for re-election.
Although, here's the point worth noting is, to be fair, the groups that have come out opposed to this, I collectively refer to usually as Silicon Valley, are also massive campaign donations.
Yeah, of course. To argue that the defeat of these bills is purely populist is is very naive.
It's actually, I mean, yeah. What I would say is, it's groups like Wikipedia said, wait a minute. Or the Wikimedia group said, wait a minute, whoa, we have a much better direct connection to people than the MPAA does. That's kind of funny. And then they just said, all right, we'll play your game. And they out-PR'd a group that PR stuff.
It's about, I mean, obviously the main problem is that this bill, you know, as written seemingly, would threaten a situation where the service providers would be sort of effectively taking sites down, making them inaccessible to people inside the United States. If it were sort of alleged, in a sense, that they were dedicated to distributing copyrighted content.
Yes, and you had to delist it from search engines and various other things.
Yeah, they get erased from the internet as far
effectively,
as
yeah, they, be-
users.
They become
which nothing is. We all know that, right? Nothing is ever erased from the internet.
There actually are websites that are essentially inaccessible in the internet because they're either old and there's no way for these tracking bugs to find them. Like, there's just no link to get to them. But these websites would become, like, those happened all naturally, this sort of undernet of websites that have simply fallen off the grid. This is something, this would be a mechanism for creating them, and that doesn't exist right now. There's nothing like that.
But from what I've heard, the point is that what you do, the recourse would be, if the MPAA alleges that this site is dedicated to make it accessible, you know, copyright content, and in fact it's not. The only thing is that you could sue the MPAA, therefore, for damages. They'd be liable.
Right.
But that, obviously, I mean, America is a very litigious society, and that could get really messy, therefore. You
know, expensive.
That's very expensive.
So it allows them to throw their weight around to people who can't really fight back.
Right. Now, keep in mind, the purpose of the law isn't – this tends to get missed in some conversations – the Digital Millennia Copyright Act handles a lot of these situations already. However, it's under the purveyance of U.S. law, which means if the website operates outside of the United States, you can't really bring the website operator to a court inside the U.S. to shut down their website because they'll just say, I'm not coming. What are you going to do? So what they did instead was this is an idea of, all right, we'll just block all access to this website. We can't shut you down, but we can make it so nobody can see you, so F you. And, I mean, there's a legitimate reality here that a lot of piracy websites are now run outside of the United States. This is a fact, and almost all of the counterfeit websites are. We're selling counterfeit products because they're produced outside of the United States. There is no effective mechanism currently enshrined in law from someone in the U.S. to force a website being hosted in China, showing television programs that no one in China is legally allowed to watch back to Americans. There's no mechanism for stopping that except asking the Chinese, hey, can you please enforce this? And then they'll say, yeah, sure we will, and then they won't.
And no one has more regard for intellectual property than the Chinese.
The Russians are really good at it, too.
Yeah, the Russians, where every copy of Windows is pirated.
Let me tell
you. Yeah.
So there's a legitimate concern here. So there are... The people who wrote the law understood the internet well enough to understood that you could do this, that you could get into the DNS system and say, haha, you can't go there now, can you, bitch? And literally just redirect it. But that is so fundamentally opposed to how the DNS works, the domain name system, that essentially it made the people who are the backbone of the internet aghast. So for Google, this would be a catastrophe because they are probably the biggest source of DNS lookups in the world. And it would be horrifying to them. So there is a need for something.
Clearly, yeah. I mean, however much money is actually lost, again, we don't really know, but it's just a fact. At the end of the day, there would be more investment in creative industries if people actually got the full return on that investment.
Yeah.
And that would mean more great games, more great movies, more everything that we enjoy.
Less drugs made out of goat testicles from China.
And just to put all of this in context, even though piracy seems like a problem that can never be solved because there's too many pirates, it's too easy to do, there's too many people who want it for free.
Right.
Louis C.K. put a one-hour comedy special as a video file on the internet, sold it for $10, and made $1 million in a day. Yep. So it is possible to sell things on the internet and make money.
No, it is. But it remember,
is. If you do it right, it is possible.
It's very interesting. It's kind of like new school against old school business-wise in terms of the media.
You know, I've heard it described as Northern California versus Southern California. And for the first time ever, Northern California won.
Yeah.
I don't think the bills are dead. I mean, they will be reevaluated at some point. But I think at some point someone's going to come back and write something that's a bit less reactionary than a lot of the news articles you read on websites like The Atlantic or in the New York Times. I think you'll see someone who can evaluate the situation better as the moment it is. However, we've strayed very far from Nintendo's position.
Hey, video games are fun.
Yeah. Basically, in summary, Nintendo just doesn't want to make a comment because they pay someone to comment for them.
Yeah, they aren't the only ones either. There's quite a few companies.
No, in fact, Sony and Microsoft are in the weird place of they pay two different groups they're members of to take diametrically opposed positions.
Yeah. Nice. All right, so James has the final letter this week.
Ryan writes, I'm greatly enjoying the fresh yet classical approach Nintendo EAD has taken with Super Mario 3D Land. When compared to the previous handheld Mario title, Super Mario 3D Land is a completely different league and deserves unanimous praise. It got me to buy my first handheld. But I think it's easy to forget the genius that the Galaxy series is. To me, the level of creativity is not quite to that standard in Super Mario 3D Land. I understand that the EAD team was under a deadline for this game's release. I read it in the Iwata Asks. And they have delivered a fine product despite restrictions, especially for on-the-go gaming. Moving forward with the Wii U in the next major 3D Mario game, do you think Nintendo will incorporate an open-world layout similar to Super Mario 64, Sunshine, and even Galaxy to access world levels, or do you see them moving towards the New Super Mario Bros. W? Wii, I guess, but just in general, New Super Mario Bros. I was like, why is the Wii one being singled out here?
Because he's never played the first one because this is his first handheld.
That's true. Galaxy 2 and Super Mario 3D Land motif of having the levels in a map layout. Which would you prefer? I personally enjoy the open world design because it allows for more creativity in the overall game's story and structure. And the biggest question, what will Mario look like in 1080p? Mario will have all your P's.
Tattoos, body hair all over the place.
Yep. Big
wrenches.
Guns.
They'll finally have the polygons to model his plumbing toolkit.
Covered, absolutely soaked in turtle blood.
He'll look a lot more like Wario.
Actually, fun fact, Mario doesn't wear red. That's just turtle blood.
Photorealistic Ron Jeremy. That was my
yep. Yeah. That's what he'll look like.
No, Mario
will
look the same in 1080p. Now, I think the world around him will look a little different.
I remember when we saw the Smash Brothers on GameCube, the first thing people commented on was, whoa, Mario's pants have texture.
Right.
But with the actual games, they don't ever really get into that detail. It just, right. If you look at the way the pre-rendered character art looks in Super Mario 64, obviously the graphics couldn't reach that standard. But if you look at the character art, that's pretty much where they pitch it at with graphics now that can get to that point. You know, that sort of sheen that it's got, that plastic kind of look. You know, not too detailed, just kind of like a plastic figure. That's what he looks like to them pretty much since 64. And so you'll be able to realize that a bit sharper, a bit shinier on Wii U, but that's what he's going to look like, no doubt about it. Now, in terms of how they're going to approach a new game, a new 3D game, obviously we know they've got the side-scrolling one coming out presumably quite early, but it is...
Well, that's not officially a game, guys.
It is an interesting dilemma, I think, because Obviously, the 3D games have been getting progressively more linear, and that's culminated in 3D Land on 3DS. But then with Wii U, we've got New Super Mario Brothers. That's an ongoing side-scrolling thing. We've got 3D Land, which is very much like a side-scrolling thing. So, I mean, does that suggest that they're going to keep it in that ballpark, or does it say, well, the room is to do something different and actually offer, you know, a more distinct Mario experience on the console that you aren't getting anywhere else? I mean, I personally tend to think they will continue to move away from it. You know, you look at this whole thing of having the castle in Mario 64, or, you know, Delfino Island, and even to some extent the Comet Observatory in the original Galaxy.
Wow, that's a stretch.
Well, it's the thing about the Comet Observatory is it had none of the benefits of the castle, but the drawbacks were still intact.
Yes,
because exactly. What I don't like about that whole structure is it's basically just putting sort of these layers between you and just playing the level, the challenge, which is what you want to do. Well, I've got to open this door and go to this room, and then I'll, you know, jump through the painting and all this kind of stuff. Now, in the original Mario 64, I would say the way in which it worked well was that it gave it a sense of place.
Right.
And that, you know, when you were this revolutionary 3D game, that was actually, you know, quite an important thing to establish. But obviously, since that time, I don't think that is such an important thing to establish.
In Delfino Island, it's not? I think that is a great hub world for Mario.
It's very big, though. I mean, in a bad way.
It's a nice hub world, but at the same time, I just think it's not so kind of important to establish it anymore with Mario games in 3D that it's like, oh, it's all part of this big 3D world that's all connected, because that's what this game is about, is being 3D. Like, it's like, now, it's like, no, we're embracing the old way. These are discrete levels, and you're just going from start to finish. You know, the fact that they've kind of gone off on this path, it just makes it less important. And the weird thing with the Comet Observatory was that they kept this vestigial attachment to it, but it didn't really have any kind of sense of place. It was just a bunch of little doors around.
You're right, and some of them were a pain in the butt to get to.
It was just sort of pointless, really, as a weird little adherence to an old convention that had pretty much lost all its use. So certainly, if you were going to do it, by all means, do it more like Delfino Plaza. Do it so that it's actually tied in to the world, to the game. But I don't think that that's what they're looking to do with Mario games anymore. For instance, do I think they're going to make another Mario game that has one unifying theme, like the Tropical Resort Island? No. So straight away, it doesn't really lend itself to having a hub world that's tied into that theme.
Galaxy kind of has a one unified theme, though. I mean, there's a lot of variety within that, and I would argue even in Sunshine there's a lot of variety within that theme.
Not Galaxy-esque levels of variety.
But not nearly Galaxy-esque.
They expanded it, but I'm a defender of Sunshine. I have been for a long time. I like that game more than a lot of other people.
Because you've got Stockholm Syndrome, yeah.
But I like Sunshine a great deal, but I think Nintendo have looked at it and thought, well, you know, ultimately, I probably did kind of box us in a bit, you know, and why not go completely the other direction with Galaxy, and you go into space, and obviously it had the space theme, although even that was toned down in Galaxy 2. Yeah. Far more blue skies and Mario kind of feel to that one.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So that's probably where they'll continue to go with it. The only question for me would be whether they think that there's some sort of mileage in doing a sort of contrarian game, because, you know, there was a time where New Super Mario Brothers was the first original side-scrolling Mario in 15 years. That right. is very much not the case anymore.
No, it's like the 8th. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you could say, well, you know, it's cyclical kind of thing. Maybe it's coming back around. But I don't know whether there's the people at Nintendo that are passionate about making that kind of Mario game anymore.
Right. Well,
then give it to somebody who is. John, you've played dozens of Super Mario Brothers games.
He's played hundreds of them.
Hundreds. What is your opinion on this? Which one do you prefer?
I kind of prefer, I just because I'm kind of old school Super Mario World style, so I kind of prefer the map, just kind of.
Old. You're just kind of old, John.
I think Super Mario World's a really nice sweet spot, because on the one hand, it did give you a sense that there was this one big location, and that everything was interconnected, and there was all sorts of weird interconnections of the star roads and all that stuff. But at the same time, because it wasn't 3D, it was never really putting a substantial amount of time between you and actually getting into the level you wanted to get to. So it kind of added something without slowing things down. That's the kind of thing that I like. You know, I mean, obviously, when you get to 3D land, I mean, it pretty much is the most basic menu. You just get that little preview of it, which it doesn't give you anything. But on the other hand, you go to the level you want and you play it. I'm fine with that. I quite like a no-nonsense approach to Mario.
Yeah, I guess that is the new chic. I mean, that seems to be the way people like it. Maybe that makes me old-fashioned, but I'm still in the camp who wants them to basically make Mario 64 on steroids, where basically the entire 3D world is the levels. And so in other words, it would be like the Mushroom Kingdom castle, Peach's castle in 64, but instead of just jumping into paintings, which is to some extent a technological limitation of the time, you know, they couldn't load all these levels at the same time, so they gave you this one place that you loaded into another one. But I basically want not only the hub world, but I would like all the levels to basically just be integrated with that, so that there's no loading screen, there's no transition point. It's just you go off in that direction for one level, and you go off in this direction for another level, and they give you very quick ways to travel across that distance. I'm not saying jump in a cannon and you know, warp to another place, but jump on Yoshi and fly over back to the hub world so you can now go to a different level. I mean, I want that because I would like for the Mushroom Kingdom or whatever setting they choose to really feel like a place, and it's one reason that I'm not as crazy about the new Super Mario Brothers series or the Galaxy series as I was about 64 and Sunshine, because I feel like it had kind of gotten down to just a level select menu, and I really feel like the Mario franchise has lost some of the world-building charm that they seem to be really intent on developing, and that is a really big part of why I like those games, and I hate to see them abandon that forever.
Oh yeah, I want to play a card here, and I've been sitting on it for a little bit, which is I would love to see something like 64 and not something like Sunshine. For me, Sunshine, it was stuff wasn't really hidden as much as it wasn't. I mean, in 64, there were like fake walls. Like, you could just jump through the wall and all of a sudden you're on this slide through the belly of the castle.
The castle is more clever than Delfino Island's very pretty. I like the feel, I like the tone of it.
It's still pretty utilitarian.
I agree. It's not as explorable. There's not as much hidden stuff.
See, to me, you could beat 64 and not find pretty much any of the secrets in the castle. But having the castle
absolutely. Because, I mean, think about 70 stars, 120, a lot of that extra 50 you might have in the castle.
But coming out of a level and saying, okay, I've just opened up a new part of the castle. I need to start digging around and see what I can find. Mm-hmm. That was always really exciting for me.
But one of the things I really don't like about the old style, and this is still true.
Which old are we talking about?
Well, of Super Mario 64 and Sunshine.
The new old style.
This is even an issue to some extent in Galaxy 2, but it really isn't nearly to the same extent, is that the whole thing of like, okay, you get a star and then you've got to come back out and then you've got to go back
in. And we talked about
I mean, it's just
this.
Like, why is that layer between me and playing the game?
There are absolutely refinements to be made, Greg.
Well, and we actually talked about this when I mentioned having played Banjo-Tooie on the 360.
It doesn't do it. Exactly.
Yeah, it just says, all right, next puzzle piece. And, of course, part of the reason is it reconfigures the levels, and Banjo-Tooie effectively doesn't. It just made these big, gigantic levels that are just far too big.
Yeah, you could do everything at once in Banjo-Kazooie levels, whereas obviously with Mario, they would remix them. And then the reason why that's not such an issue in Galaxy is because there are fewer things in one level.
Mm-hmm. In Galaxy 2 especially, because in the first Galaxy, you had to deal with those freaking comets where they would just show up and you have to go get them. And
I think what we've established is a very clear direction of travel, where they're getting less concerned about having these kind of scenario-based kind of activities that lie between you and the level. They're very clearly getting away from that and just saying, you know, what people care about in Mario games, what most people care about, is just the level, the platforming action. Let's go to it. So, and I mean, you get the feeling that even though I can't imagine that they're going to make something for Wii U that's just like Super Mario 3D Land 2, I would be very surprised.
New Mario Brothers 3D Land.
I would fly to Japan and punch someone in the face.
Like, I'd be very surprised if it were that. And just even to some extent, just because I think the stereoscopic 3D does add something to 3D Land. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether it would quite work the same just on a console, but I don't see it going against this direction of travel that they've got going, which in some ways, for fans of the old style, it is a bit of a shame. And it wouldn't be so bad if there were other people kind of out there making quality 3D platformers that worked that way.
Right. I think these two bloodlines can coexist. And the problem is it really feels like they're letting one dry up while they favor the other one so heavily.
Right.
And I like the Galaxy games just fine. I like 3D Land a whole lot. And I want those kind of, I think the fact that Nintendo is still making 2D platformers is a wonderful thing. And I want them to keep doing it. And maybe what they need to do is just go back to 64 or Sunshine, whichever you think is a better departure point, and maybe continue off of there and just call it a different franchise. Just don't even use Mario anymore. You know, you make a new character or whatever, but they're not even doing
call
that.
Jumpman.
I feel like they've really just kind of let, Nintendo invented the 3D platformer with Mario 64. They weren't the first ones to do it, but they invented that shit, okay? And yet, they've really not pursued it in the long term. Other people are still trying to make it. And look, their work on Mario 64 led us to things like Uncharted, okay? That stuff, that is a 3D platform in a lot of ways. It wouldn't exist without 64. But I feel like Nintendo has really let that genre die. And that kind of world building, even if you look at like Zelda Skyward Sword, they've gone away from this idea of it being one contiguous world that it's yours to explore, and it feels enormous, and you get this amazing sense of immersion in this place. Now they've broken up in these little pieces, and you have this hub world where you kind of teleport from one to another, and they never connect to each other, and you're kind of going back and forth a lot. And to me, that is not as satisfying.
Yeah, the shift has gone from exploring to puzzle solving, straight puzzle solving.
Yeah, they've made these franchises so bite-sized that I never feel like I get enough bite. You know, I can get as many bites as I want, but no single bite is big enough to really satisfy what I like about these franchises. They used to do it, they don't do it anymore, and that's a shame to me.
I think a lot of it is because of the N64 as well, of that era. A lot of their design priorities were based around this idea of we're pioneering in 3D.
They were so ambitious. So ambitious back then.
Exactly. It was really ambitious. It's like we're trailblazing all that, and we want to do all these big worlds. We want it to really impress people that, you're not fiddling around with a polygonal character on a pre-rendered background or anything. This is a 3D world and you could go anywhere in it. That was really informing their design choices. But of course, once the novelty of that wears off, it seems like they don't really have the appetite for it in-house.
I'm not quite so reactionary to this. I mean, I still think
I'm not reactionary. I'm just wistful. I think it's a missed opportunity.
The assertion that they've abandoned the 3D platformer to me feels a bit overblown.
Well, they've just gone down one path very much, decisively now.
Right. I mean, they haven't abandoned it. They just defined what a 3D platformer is in their
realm. And like I said, if you had a bunch of developers making games that kind of took it in the other direction, perhaps you wouldn't feel it as acutely. I mean, personally, I very much approve of making it more linear and hewing to the kind of action, the immediacy of the 2D games as much as possible. But at the same time, I recognise the value in what they were doing before. I would still like to see it explored by somebody at least, so it is a shame.
It was a kind of game that really a lot of other people tried to make, and nobody really ever got the formula all that well compared to Nintendo. But the problem is even Nintendo's not making them anymore, so
I think it's lot of it's because it is really hard, and it probably creates a lot more technical obstacles, a lot more bugs, a lot more things to go wrong, and then also it's not as popular. It's just,
And by the way, I should put my money where my mouth is and download Jet Rocket. I'm overdue to do that. And, it's a smaller game, but I think it does basically kind of go for that. But yeah, there's not much out there really that even attempts to do 3D platforming anymore. And I feel like Nintendo, they have the skill to do it. They just don't seem to have the desire anymore. Well, I didn't expect that question to take us quite that far down into that territory, but it turned out to be fertile ground. So thank you, Ryan, and everyone else who wrote in this week. You can send your questions and ideas to the show at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or head over to the show notes for this episode and click the link there to send an email. So, before we go, I do want to remind everyone that we are playing Fire Emblem The Sacred Stones for Retroactive. We might talk about it next week. I guess it kind of depends on where we're at and what else is going on, but it will be soon for certain. So be sure to not get left behind. There is a very active and interesting forum thread on this game, which also includes a lot of pro tips if you're having trouble. It seems like there's some real experts. Some real Fire Emblem gurus in that thread, so they can give you some helpful information, or in my case, just kind of scare you at all the stuff going on in this game. But it's a pretty cool game. You might already have a copy of it for free on your 3DS, and we hope that you will play along, post in the forum thread, and we'll have the discussion on that very soon. And before we go, I did want to give a plug for another show that I appeared on this week as a guest. It's called the VG Tribune Roundtable. And it's hosted by a fan of RFN who has been a caller on our live shows and has written into us before. So I hope you'll go check that out. I had a good time over there and talked about all kinds of stuff. It's a multi-platform gaming podcast. So I did some 2012 predictions for non-Tendo topics.
Non-Tendo?
Go check that out. It'll be posted roughly around the same time as this episode. And when I get a link for it, I'll put that link in the show notes so you can find it. That's worth a listen as well, in addition to all the great podcasts on our network, on the NintendoWorldReport.com podcast network, including Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. I was just on an episode of that and had a really good time with TYP, and that is worth a listen. Of course, we've got connectivity every week, and there's always all kinds of crazy stuff and a menagerie of staffers appearing on that show as well. So yes, you can find them all on iTunes and over at NintendoWorldReport.com. We hope you will visit. That's all for this week, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Later.
Sega announced two, actually. They announced Rhythm Thief and Sonic at the Olympics. And so Mario and Sonic at the Olympics is both Europe and North America, but only Europe is getting Rhythm Thief, which is completely backwards because once you put Mario and Sonic in the Olympics in people's hands, they'll realize it's the worst game ever made.
I'm looking forward to playing that. I didn't play it at E3.
It is the worst game I have ever played at any
E3. It might have improved since then.
There is hope,
they
James.
Didn't get rid of the 20-mile run-walk event, so no, it didn't improve. That event still exists.
Is that an actual Olympic event?
It is, actually. It's like power walking. Terrible.
It's mall walking. Olympic mall walking.
Wow. But they put it in the game, and you do it by basically sliding an indicator on the touchscreen back and forth in rhythm
for 20 miles.
The whole game. It's terrible. And that was the game the guy had me demo at E3. I looked at him like he had 10 heads. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is the game you want me to play? Are you on drugs?
Well,
he's like, what'd you think? I just looked at him like, no.